All right, it's 8:27 here on KTWH. I promised you this interview coming in a little early, so we will go back to Curtis and Loretta soon after this. Man, I've had all these distractions this morning. I'm Katya Gordon, as you know, hostess for KTWH, and I do have a very special interview coming up right now with Ted Lewis, who is with me. Ted is with the University of Minnesota's Center for Restorative Justice and Peacemaking, which is becoming very relevant in our community as we have an event coming up to talk about restorative justice, which is a big and sometimes a complex topic that many people feel like they maybe have an idea of what it is, but not a good idea, and have hopefully a lot of questions. So I'm hoping that we'll have a good turnout on Monday for this. But Ted, meantime, thank you so much for being with us on the radio station.
Yeah, good morning. Great to join you today.
Yes, really great to see you. And I know you've been with, you've been in restorative justice for many, many years, and with the center and UMD, I think as long as it's been up in Duluth. Tell us a little bit about how and why you got interested in restorative justice in the first place. Was this your career path from right out of college, or what led you to this?
It really wasn't a career path out of college. I had gone to college and studied other things. But in my mid-30s, I was in South Dakota on Pine Ridge Reservation, met some folks that were starting a restorative justice program that was sort of customized for the tribe. And that really opened up my eyes to a whole new way of approaching justice, which wasn't about punishment and keeping victims and offenders apart. It was about empowering both parties to come together for healing dialogue and to create reparation agreements together.
Yeah.
So as a result of that, I got involved with some further work in the field.
Huh. That's really neat that it started, because I know that Indigenous communities have long done work in this manner, and in some ways we're just adopting it. How did you get involved with the Center for Restorative Justice at the university here?
Well, that was about 10 years ago. So between the time I learned about it and coming to the center, I had 15 years working with different nonprofits. I worked as a program manager. I had teams of volunteers that got training and facilitation. And that really gave me a solid foundation of doing casework. And then around 2013, I joined Mark Umbright Center, which was based down in the St. Paul campus. And that allowed me to kind of go the next step to be a trainer, a consultant, and to help new programs start.
Which is where you are now, and which is where Lake County is now. I know that we've had different whisperings of interest in restorative justice from many different arenas, turning into more than whispers just in the last year. So very exciting to have people coming together more officially right now to really talk and learn about restorative justice. Do you want to share a little bit about work you've done in other communities similar to ours and how they have benefited from this process?
Sure. I can maybe share the Cook County story, since they've been involved with this work for about 6 years now.
Absolutely.
It really comes down to what I call a blend of community resources and justice worker resources coming together. So in Cook County, the district attorney and a probation officer and a sheriff, all three of them had interests in the merits of a restorative dialogue programming to supplement their justice processes. And there were also community folk that wanted peacemaking capacities that were part of a volunteer base. So I did a couple info gatherings up there, and eventually a non-profit took a fledgling program under their wings, and it's grown quite well. They have a solid group of volunteers. There's folks in every aspect of the justice system that are supportive. So that synergy between government and community is really important.
Yeah, can you speak a little more about that? I know you've that's been one of the things you have reiterated over and over, is that you really need to have, you can't just have the system, quote unquote, doing the work, and you can't only have the community doing the work. Why is it so important to have both?
Well, I think it's because government provide safety and structure, and communities provide that relational peacemaking element that's so important for people to remain coexisting well in communities. Maybe I should just tell a story at this point, because there's probably some folks listening that are wondering, what's really this about? What does this look like?
So stories are, absolutely.
Yeah, this is kind of a classic story. It's about a 16-year-old boy that stole a four-wheeler or a quad. And he kind of came from a broken family, always wanted to have a four-wheeler, so he found a way to steal it. And after 2 months, he didn't quite know what to do with it, and the law caught up with him. So through our program, we were able to do preparatory meetings with him and his older brother, because he didn't have a father figure. And we met with the family who were the victims of the theft. And once people have kind of gone through a preparatory stage, then they agree to come together for a mediated dialogue or a facilitated dialogue. And that can last up to 2 hours. And so when they all came together, they talk about what happened, they talk about who was affected, they talk about all the impacts and consequences. And when there's fullness around that kind of discussion, usually both parties are feeling like they're connecting with each other on a deeper human level. And that's great for them. They want to rebuild trust. But there also has to be the practical side. You know, who's going to make things right? Who's going to repair stuff? And so the teenage boy then agreed to do community service work, wrote additional apology letters. He set some goals to finish his school that spring. These all get written down and then tracked. And really at the heart of all this is restoring people back to the community so that they can coexist well together. That's the beautiful part of this work, is when it goes full circle all the way to a deep and complete end, folks can be with each other in the same community.
Thank you. That is a good story and a good example of, you know, something that isn't so terribly complicated or, you know, life-threatening in any way, but can be a very big deal for those who are involved. Can you describe what might have happened had there not been any restorative process in there with this kid and his, and, you know, how the criminal justice system would have dealt with it?
He probably, you know, if he just received a charge, conviction, and punishment, he probably would have felt sort of like a victim of the system. He would never have learned about how his actions have affected other people. He would never have had a chance to apologize from the heart. And if he was just told by a judge, you know, okay, you have to do X, Y, and Z as your punishment, he probably wouldn't have had the best attitude to complete it. So what we're really trying to do in a restorative opportunity is to empower people on the inside to take responsibility for their actions and to make things better. It's really quite simple. It's like no one really changes unless they're changed from the inside out. And the only way they're going to change is by hearing something new about, you know, how other people have experienced things.
Yeah. I know, having done some restorative work myself, that often, you know, something that like this, often victims also feel really quite scared, terrified, wary, at the very least, or angry when things are stolen, you know, when people feel invaded. And it, what I have often seen is that completely flip over in this kind of a process, and victims, like in cases like this, I have noticed them often really start to care for the especially the kid. I've done it mostly with kids, and just want the best for them, really. And so they are happy to have them sometimes even work for them personally. And they really support any measure that the kid takes to not end up sort of making this a life pattern. And so I think it's can be really helpful for victims in their relationship with, and they certainly cease to be afraid of the offender. At least that's been my experience. I wouldn't want to speak for every case, but I know I've seen that as well.
Yeah, you're right about all of that. And it's really important to emphasize that all of this is voluntary, so that people on all sides choose to be part of this, and there's no arm twisting or, you know, carrots held out or anything like that. It has to just be a common sense opportunity that's chosen by people.
Yeah.
And it's fine if people don't too. What's really nice is that it also teaches people that talking through things in a respectful way is a great model for having a skill for doing that in any other part of life. People are just afraid sometimes to have open dialogue, especially in our divisive society. And so by learning how to come together over hard issues, that's a great thing for teenagers to get socialized into, and it's a great thing for victims to feel empowered to be part of.
Yes, and we're definitely never too old to learn that. I just think the empowerment with older adults too, and community members. I'm thinking about people listening to this, Ted, who maybe are not direct victims of crime, don't have any direct connection with offenders or juveniles, but yet the community plays a really important role in this too. Can you explain how that works?
Definitely. Communities have some people who are naturally gifted to do facilitation work, and part of what I'll be talking about next Monday is next steps for people to get training and orientation around that. Community members can also be mentors for youth that go through reparation agreements or help them with community service projects. Communities can do just a lot of different volunteerism to help support a program that's also partnered with the justice system. So again, you have to have that dovetailing between all the community resources and the government folk to make this work well. But governments can't do this work alone. They're stretched far too thin, and they can only do so much. So that's where the volunteerism part really makes this a rich program.
Yeah. I know, too, I've been in circles where the community members really sort of aid the process by speaking not quite so directly about the crime and harm, like speaking about the effects on them. You know, a crime affects communities in general. It affects the way people talk to each other. It affects the way people feel about their neighborhoods and their safety and security. And having all that be openly discussed can also be really enriching to a process like this. So I hope that community members who are listening really consider, you know, how they might be useful in such a process. Do you want to talk at all about, there are sort of specific differences in how, you know, different types of ways of getting together, and I believe you're going to share at least one or two of those ways on Monday. Do you want to just give us a little spoiler alert about that?
Are you talking about dialogue models?
Yes.
Yeah, really, over the last 40 years since restorative justice has grown in the North American context, the two models that are dominant are conferencing and circling. And conferencing comes out of more of a mediation-based model, but includes other people. Family members and friends can join in. And it's more of a model that lets parties eventually have direct conversation with each other. And then I'll be referencing a circle process, which is a more communal format where people sit in a circle and people respond to the same kinds of prompts that a facilitator would give, and it builds a stronger sense of we're all in this together.
Mm-hmm.
We all share a little bit of responsibility. We all share a future that can get stronger. So I'll talk about both of those models, and at times they can even be blended. Sometimes when I do my work, I do some of this work for churches in conflict. I'll use a blended model that brings aspects of both together.
Sounds wonderful. I just cannot say how pleased I am that this is going to be talked about. And I know we have support from a lot of different arenas in our government, with law enforcement and human services and the courts, but also with, and I think community members have been speaking about this for a long time. And so I think we're going to have both in Lake County. And let's just review that informational session will be coming up this Monday at the Law Enforcement Center. And let's remember the time. I want to get it right. Do you know the time offhand?
That's a good question. You're putting me in this spot.
No, I think I can find it. Here it is. 4 to 5:30.
Pardon?
4 to 5:30 this Monday.
Right.
And I know Kitty has mentioned too that people can come for just part of it. If you can't come for the whole time, you're welcome to come just to learn a little bit. If you can only come for a little bit of time, that's just fine. Ted, do you want to just, I'm curious, you've been at this for a long time, and it has, the amount of sort of support and activity in Minnesota has gone dramatically up and dramatically down at various eras. I know when I was the most involved around the turn of this, around 2000, it seemed like there was restorative justice everywhere, and we were leading the country in many ways. Where are we at right now in Minnesota with restorative justice, and how do you feel about where we're at right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say Minnesota's history has more ups and downs, and restorative work has worked well in pockets, but hardly at a widespread level.
So yeah.
I think where we're at right now is a pretty good place, because just a month ago, the state legislature passed a bill that supports restorative work for youth offenders and their victims in every county in Minnesota. In other words, they're going to start allocating funds to every counties, you know, really focusing on rural counties, so that at some level they are building in programming that's restorative in nature, that has a dialogue dimension. And that's pretty exciting, because up till now, you know, it's really been the magic within any given county if enough stakeholders pull together a program. There's probably about a dozen in Minnesota right now. It's really going to allow a nice expansion. And I think Lake County is really at a prime spot to access those state funds that are going to be made available now.
Yeah, it does seem like a really good time to really take advantage of a lot of different things coming together, and as well as state support. So, and then final question, Ted, what keeps you in this work? Do you ever get discouraged?
Oh, it's hard at times. I won't deny that, because when you're dealing with harms and conflicts, and sometimes those go way back for people, it can be hard and messy work. But what keeps me in it is when people are willing to kind of get out of their head space and move into their heart space and be open, apologetic, sincere, empathetic, and this is on both sides, really amazing things happen. You know, when you bear witness to people having heart-to-heart talk, it's just really a sacred moment. And I live for those times when people can start to let go the heaviness of the past and live freer into a better future.
Well, thank you so much, Ted, for being with us. And hopefully many of us will see you on Monday at 4 o'clock.
All right. Thanks, Katya.
You take care. Bye-bye. That was Ted Lewis. He is a trainer and facilitator and consultant at the Center for Restorative Justice and Peacemaking at the University of Minnesota Duluth. And he will be in Two Harbors at the Law Enforcement Center on Monday at 4 p.m. From 4 to 5:30, and hope to see you all there.